people, thanks for listening to THC and taking a serious look at some of the most underappreciated topics and ideas on the planet today. UFOs, HARP, a resource-based economy, archons, psychedelics, MKUltra mind control, Hollywood sorcery, self-sustainability, and a ton of other stuff. We want the truth about the topics that spark our curiosity and expose corruption, but it's become buried in an avalanche of glee in the Fast and the Furious movies. Well, not anymore. Folks, if you like listening to the show week after week, please take a second to nominate us in the 2013 Stitcher Awards, the most prestigious podcast awards known to man. And what could be a real shining star on the Higher Side Chat's resume? It gives your humble host the clout necessary to remove all barriers that may stand in the way of reaching potential guests and allows the momentum to continue. So please take a second to find a link on my Facebook, Twitter, or the Google itself for the 2013 Stitcher Awards and write THC in wherever you think it fits. Why not try to sweep the whole damn thing? But particularly, let me extract your precious nomination in the science and medicine category. I don't know why our show is listed there, but we're 14th in that category, which means we're in the ballpark, but we're going to need the whole team to make it happen. We're 14th. That's pretty good. 14th above Michio Kaku, above Scientific American, above National Geographic. Don't get me wrong. We've done great things this year, you and I. But a nomination in the Stitcher Awards means putting Lennon Honor and Freeman Fly and Wendy Tremaine and Jim Elvidge and Jock Fresco alongside people like Rachel Maddow, Joe Rogan, NPR, and ESPN, because those are the people who will win the 2013 Stitcher Awards, and that's okay. But help me put Project Monarch alongside fantasy football. Help me put Crop Circles alongside the NBC Nightly News, even for just one day, and I'd say we've come further than we ever have. So please, vote every day between now and December 22nd. This year, let's get on that ballot. And next year, that's the year we go for the gold. Your move, Higher Side Chatters.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Welcome to the show, people. Wow, pretty good one today. We got Dr. John Apsley, who's written the book Fukushima Meltdown. He's got some very disturbing news about radiation and the reactor, and he's going to help us cut through the propaganda surrounding nuclear radiation, the Fukushima disaster, and also cancer itself, which John seems to have the cure for. And before we get into that, we have one other pressing matter. That's right, it's episode 85, the big day we've been waiting for, the THC Money Bomb winner. Thanks for all the donations. Thanks for all the support. I'd say it was pretty successful. I wasn't sure how it was going to go. Here are a few facts about the THC Money Bomb. 32 people donated. Not a lot. Not very many. I want to give a special thank you for those people who donated over 20 bucks. Robert, Michael, Graham, April, Con, and Ian. That's fucking awesome. Over 20 fucking dollars. That's a goddamn DVD right there. We got one donation for 100 bucks, one donation for 50 bucks, one donation for 40 bucks, one for 30, one for 25, and several for 20 and everything below. $523.23 in total. Someone did donate $23.23, so thanks for rounding that out for me. $16 was the average donation. 32 people sent in money. 5 cards in the P.O. Box. So that is 37 people. And I gave half, $262, rounded it up for them, to my man James out in Michigan. So I'd say that was successful, but man, only 32 people out of thousands. There are tens of thousands of people listening. And I understand it is hard out there. Do what you got to do. But, you know, even if just a fraction of the audience played, if 5,000 people put in $5, we'd be looking at $25,000, you know, half of which is 12 and a half grand. That's a lot of money to give away. And that's really too fucking much for me to keep. But, you know, what I'm trying to say is that just a few people donating makes a huge impact. And if we can even get that number from 32 people donating an average of $16 up to just 1,000 people donating $5, I can quit my job and just do this and make this show dominant as fuck and give away $2,500 every month. That would be huge. And I think this thing is pretty awesome. I think it's been pretty successful for a first shot. I recommend you go to any other podcast that you like and you say, hey, why aren't you doing this? Why are you not giving back to your audience? You'll make more in donations. Your audience will love you for it. Spread the word. This is the new for podcasts. I really believe it could be. But anyway, thanks for the support. Thanks for making a difference in this person's life and my life. So without any more from me, here's the first of hopefully many THC Money Bomb winners. Boom. Folks, I'm here with James in Redford, Michigan. James donated $10 to the show and ended up getting $262 back as the winner of the first THC Money Bomb. That money is made up of all your money, all the people who donated. So James, say hello to the people.
Hello, people.
I got to say, man, when I saw that you were from Michigan, because I get all that info, it's attached to your PayPal account, I was pleased to see something good happening from Michigan finally. I mean, it's been a rough couple years for you guys. How close are you to Detroit, actually?
Actually, very close. About 5-10 minutes away. I was born and raised there, so I'm there all the time.
Damn. Is it as bad as everyone says, or is it a little bit of media hype? What do you think?
I think a lot of it is media hype, but at the same time, there's a lot of problems everywhere you look.
Aren't there always, man? Well, I wanted to say congratulations on being the first Money Bomb winner, and thank you for donating. You had no idea you were going to win, so it's, you know, just to get people to listen to your show is tough, but then to have people willingly give up money when they don't have to. I mean, $10, to give up $10 of your own money, man, much appreciated.
Yeah, it means a lot. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of the show. I listen all the time. You know, I'm just glad that I could do anything to help support the show and the work you do.
Oh, well, thanks, man. So you got any plans for the people's money? I know 262 isn't a huge ton of fundage, but it is a decent amount for a lot of us out there.
It is certainly a decent amount, at least especially to me. I don't have any concrete plans, but I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to use it to pay for an exam that I've been studying for, a networking certification exam.
Awesome. A worthy yeah. cause.
It will be.
I think the people would be proud to help facilitate making your career path slightly easier. That is awesome. Good luck on that.
Yeah, it certainly helps.
How long you been listening? You have a favorite guest or topic?
You know what? Every show is interesting and it's all right. I can't name anything in particular.
Right on. Is there anybody you think I should get or any topics you think we should cover more often?
No, not in particular. I think you're doing a fine job. I just started listening this earlier this year, a few months back. So I still got to go through some of the other episodes that you got up at the website and give those a listen. But I've been impressed, and every episode is pretty interesting.
Well, again, much appreciated. Can't say it enough. Is there anything else you want to say to the people before I cut you loose?
No, just I appreciate everyone who donates. I'll still be supporting the show when I can with what I can. And, you know, eventually, sometime soon, I will be buying a conspiracy.
Oh, shit. No way. Awesome, yeah. Man. Which one's your favorite?
I think Quit Your Job. Yeah.
The Quit Your Job. Man, yeah. Powerful. Powerful message. All right, man. Well, thanks again, James. Congratulations. Good luck on that exam. Take care of yourself.
All right. Appreciate it.
Peace.
Hi, everybody. Over the past month, I've been visiting towns across America, talking about what our country needs to secure a better bargain for the middle class. Some form of higher education.
One shining beacon of hope for THC listeners is the news coming out of a weed study led by UCSF and the University of Alabama. They collected data from more than 5,000 U.S. adults for more than 20 years, and they concluded what's been said before, that moderate marijuana use is way less harmful than tobacco. And something that was a bit more surprising and newsworthy was that the evidence points to slight increases in lung airflow rates and increases in lung volume from occasional marijuana use. They added that those increases, though not large, nonetheless were statistically significant, and the data shows that even up to moderately high-level uses, which to them was one joint a day for 7 years, there is no evidence of decreased airflow rates or lung volumes. Just more evidence that marijuana is not some killer drug, and even if it was, it doesn't fucking matter. Let people just do whatever the hell they want to themselves. Who gives a shit? You can shoot heroin into your neck for all I care. If you think it makes Battlestar better and you're not hurting anyone, go for it. Moving on, and this is highly speculative and also a little arousing, in what will soon be considered as the holy grail of extraterrestrial research, the Mexican government has released ancient documents proving the existence of ETs once and for all. Newly released Mayan documents and artifacts dating back at least 1,300 years reveal that the human race is not alone, and highly advanced technologies, including space travel, have likely existed for quite some time. Not only does this documentation released by the Mexican government show the existence of an explorer race, it may also reveal the roots of mankind. Some consider the government's presentation of the information to be a major step forward for humanity, as the truth is finally being slowly let out. Hopefully, this will prompt other governments around the world to be more forthcoming with such information, turning the tide in the UFO and extraterrestrial research community for good. Now, the producer of a documentary, Raul Julia Levy, said that the documentary makers were working in cooperation with the Mexican government for what he said was, quote, the good of mankind. He said the order to collaborate had come directly from the country's president. And I quote him saying, Mexico will release codexes, artifacts, and significant documents with evidence of Mayan and extraterrestrial contact, and all of their information will be corroborated by archaeologists, he said. The Mexican government is not making the statement on their own. Everything we say, we're going to back up, says the statement released by Julia Levy. Now, what's funny is I tweeted this story, and that producer, Julia Levy, wrote me back and told me incredible things are unfolding, and he appreciates what I'm doing. And I looked into his story, and it's a bit sketchy. He was somehow affiliated and involved in the Phil Spector trial, and he's been known to use fake names and aliases. And the man that he claims is his father actually says that that's not true and that this guy is just crazy. So who knows? But he's got 10,000 followers, so there's some clout. I think there may be some truth to the idea that, at least on the lower levels, it's American power holding this info back. And as the American empire loses its stranglehold on life, some smaller countries are going to start defying our leadership and our censorship, and good on them. Well, I'm going to leave it at that. It's a wild world out there, and that's your higher education. How's it going, folks? We've been due for a health show for some time, and this is really going to be a great one. Anyone looking at alternative news will know that we keep hearing that the government has been lying about the serious consequences of the Fukushima disaster, so I thought I'd get a man who's written the book on it. Fukushima Meltdown is what it's called, and he's going to walk us through some of the details on just how bad the fallout is from this event, and it doesn't seem good, people. Today's guest has also done some really interesting work in regenerative medicine as well, which has been his specialty for over 30 years. His name is John Apsley, and it's a pleasure to have him here. John, welcome to THC.
Well, thank you. It's Greg, it's a real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, man, thanks for taking the time. I know you're a busy, hardworking guy. I appreciate you coming on a show like this to talk to me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. One of the things that is so helpful is folks like yourself that are getting the word out. You know, as a physician, I don't run into the kinds of difficulties that we have encountered since Fukushima, but maybe once or twice in a lifetime, and it presents all kinds of difficulties. So by getting the word out to your listeners today, at least they can take some action on their own end by getting educated and knowing some things that can dramatically help them if they should happen to get sick. So,
Absolutely, man. It seems like it's a very serious thing. I mean, obviously, you've been studying the effects of this disaster in great detail, and you've called for the highest level alert on this. And then we've talked about the disaster a bit recently on the show, but bring us up to speed. Kind of give us your synopsis of how bad this fallout really is from this thing.
Well, we have to go through the historical way in which that the governments, the various governments involved with a nuclear accident or nuclear fallout from either above ground or below ground testing, what they've done over the past 60 or 70 years, both here in the United States as well as in the Soviet Union. And then we can see what the propaganda methodology is, and then we can see more clearly what is actually happening present time. So for an example,
sure.
Well, after Chernobyl, the Soviets outlawed the reporting of any death or any injury due to the Chernobyl incident. That was in 1987. And it took 25 years for a group of dedicated epidemiologists, a group of about five medical doctors who were all Russian, to go clinic by clinic and collect file by file and then review 5,000 medical journal publications that were in Russian, to determine that we, as opposed to Wikipedia's report that there were only 31 people that died, that the actual figure was 1 million people had died.
What? Whoa.
And then the amount of crippled human beings, we're talking totally crippled. We're not talking about people that can function normally in just about any parameter. That number was 8 million. And if we look at what's happened at Fukushima, we're looking at, as my book that was published in 2011 forecasted, where we're looking at least six times that number of lethal fallout reaching both northern Japan as well as the western coast here of North America. So my prediction back in 2011 now has been verified by repeated studies that have shown, despite the propaganda that was out that most of the radiation went into the ocean or was contained into the facility at Fukushima, because it sits right on the ocean front on the east side of Japan in the north, that they were basically covering up the truth and they were doing a grand effort to do so. Well, just last week, because there's been a substantial amount of truth that's come out about it by the international community that is as educated as I and even more educated than I. They know how to shift through the propaganda machine. The parliament in Japan voted to outlaw any report, any data that came out of the Fukushima incident going forward. So the same thing that the Soviets did in 1987 was just last week reported through the parliament, reproduced by way of a law change in the nation of Japan. Now, that means that there's reason for them to be super concerned, because up until now, they've been doing all sorts of propaganda techniques, and they've been very successful at enabling the mainstream media to say everything is hunky-dory. Mm-hmm. And classic methodology, very classic. Oh, the dilution factor will take care of this. As it goes into the Pacific Ocean, it's no big deal. It's less exposure for anyone here in North America than it is to a general chest X-ray or normal background radiation. All this BS that is classic propaganda that comes out, and yet what we're actually dealing with is nothing less than a catastrophe. And now we have an escalation. And so getting back to your point about that I've issued the highest level alert, we now have three, to the best knowledge that's currently available, and I'm going to say this outright, most of the scientists that I use to back up this statement have to maintain a certain level of scientific conservatism, mm-hmm. where they wouldn't quite put it into these words. But from all evidence, it's quite clear to those who will be blunt that units 1, 2, and 3 have suffered a total China syndrome. That's a complete meltdown. And each one of those is equivalent and even more equivalent than one Chernobyl. So let's say that there are now three Chernobyls for sure that have happened at over there at Fukushima. There's a total of five reactor buildings over there. Six altogether. And now we have Unit 4, which was not online during the earthquake and the subsequent tsunami. Unit 4 is actually potentially more dangerous in my mind and in my calculations than Units 1, 2, and 3, which are an absolute total catastrophe. As an example to give your listeners an understanding, the events that have happened in Units 1, 2, and 3, and my statement, my opinion, that Unit 4 is actually much worse, goes like this. We have the amount of nuclear fuel that's melted down and entered into the atmosphere, mostly in the northern hemisphere, and into the Pacific Ocean, that each one of those units will cause the same number of deaths and crippling injuries as one Chernobyl. So we have Unit 1 that can do it, we have Unit 2 that can do it, and we have Unit 3, meaning that we have three Chernobyls. That's 3 million people dead over the next 20 to 25 years, and anywhere from 8 to 25 million people permanently crippled. These are mostly children that are getting exposed right now. So now we're going to talk about Unit 4. And in my opinion, although some of my much more esteemed colleagues would argue that Unit 3 is by far the more dangerous, and we'll get into that real briefly, I still will make the claim that Unit 4 can be much more dangerous, and here's why. Unit 4 was not active, but it was storing a great deal of radioactive fuel at the time of the tsunami. Mm-hmm. And when that wave hit, Greg, the entire building was whacked. And the groundwater that normally comes in from the surrounding hillside that flows into the Pacific Ocean has to go through that property anyway. So between the tsunami and the normal groundwater system, and these buildings are enormously heavy. They're just really, really super heavy, and they're tall, and they contain swimming pools at the very top. The ground was soggy with moisture. And so after the earthquake, the violent shaking, it was a 9.0 earthquake, and then the tsunami, which was huge, and then the saturated water already in the ground due to the massive amount of groundwater that's just always present there, that building began to tilt. And when that building began to tilt, there was the risk that it would topple over, like the Tower of Pisa that actually kind of topples over. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. There is such an enormous amount of radioactive fuel that's stored there that if that swimming pool should collapse and the water should leak out, there would be what we call a criticality event, where there would be no way to keep the stored fuel there from going superheated. And once that superheated fuel attains about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what happened within a few hours after the swimming pool would drain, you would have an uncontrollable fire. And once that uncontrollable fire took off, they would have to evacuate the facility. They would only have robots that could possibly do anything at that point, and we're not technologically along far enough that the robots could solve what would wind up happening after that. It turns out, Greg, that 200 feet away, maybe 300 feet away, one of the world's largest storage facilities of older spent nuclear fuel is just sitting there. And it's fully automated, and it wasn't damaged during the initial tsunami and earthquake, but it has to run off of electricity. And if there's a criticality fire in that Unit 4 that causes the evacuation of everybody at the site, eventually the electrical systems that keep that other, it's called the common fuel storage facility, that eventually will fail. It might take a week, it might take 2 weeks, might be a little bit longer. But as long as that criticality fire was ongoing, and again, there's no way to stop it once it starts at Unit 4, there would be no way for human beings to get back in there to help maintain that common storage fuel facility. So when I took the amount of potential radioactive cesium and radioactive strontium, which are the two most toxic things in that one of the world's largest storage fuel pools, that common storage fuel pool that's 300 to 250 feet away from Unit 4, and you add that on top of Unit 1, Unit 2, Unit 3, and Unit 4, you will have a massive release of radioactivity that will not only poison the entire northern half of Japan down to Tokyo, but will waft into the air and will rinse into the ocean that will poison the environment for at least 300 years.
Oh my God.
Now, the half-life on these two radioactive particles that I mentioned, cesium and strontium, the half-life is only 30 years. But that doesn't mean that it goes away after 30 years. It means that its biological impact to kill, to maim, to go into the food chain, to be magnified up the food chain, depending upon, like we human beings, we sit at the very top of the food chain, right? Mm-hmm. That magnification of how this low-level amount of radiation, as it spreads into the water and it spreads into the air, eventually accumulates up the food chain, that becomes concentrated by 300-fold given enough time. So now Stephen Wing in Chapel Hill North Carolina University, one of the premier experts in epidemiology, PhD in the field, says that, look, he said, when you have a total release of radioactivity, it doesn't matter if it's diluted. It will still cause the same number of cancers and crippling illnesses regardless. It just might take additional time. And one of the reasons is because of the magnification, the accumulation that occurs in the food chain. So what we're looking at here is exactly what happened at Chernobyl, but it's multiplied at least sixfold. And then one last thing, Greg, there are seven times the amount of the population in the given regions, because Chernobyl was relatively in a remote area. But in the case of Japan and the western coast of North America, you're talking about seven times the population of people.
Yeah, very dense.
So it's very dense. Okay, so what this means to your listeners is this. Where you have already experienced where rainfall occurred on the western part of North America and even inland in the heartland of North America during the time that the plumes went up from Fukushima and were carrying this fallout into the upper atmosphere, when there were rainstorms that really dumped during those exact time periods where the fallout was crossing over the U.S., those cities that got hit experienced from a 60% increase in infant death rate to a 40% increase in infant death rates. The reason being, this is from Centers of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. The reason is because the first thing that gets wigged out during exposure to relatively small amounts of radiation is the thyroid. The thyroid keeps your body warm, mm-hmm. and it makes your immune system work. So anybody who was either really immature because they were a baby or really old and weak, they start dropping like flies from the common cold and the common flu. Normally, it wouldn't have bothered them. But they were just that much weaker due to that amount of fallout that hit. Now, that data was published not once, not twice, but three times in the peer-reviewed medical literature. And everyone went into denial about it because of the propaganda machine. It's clear as a bell. The CDC data doesn't lie. If you rule out, okay, could this have been caused by any other reason? The answer is no. As soon as the plumes traveled around the northern hemisphere and eventually, you know, most of it got dropped down or were in dry areas where there's what we call a rain shadow, those areas either remained with normal amounts of death in the young or the extremely old, or after the time frames when the rain hit and then went away, the death rates went back to normal. So you could see clearly that the only explainable event that caused these increased death rates had to be due to Fukushima. Next thing, you're going to love this.
Okay.
In my book, at the University of Berkeley, the physics department, there were some PhD candidates there that were keeping really careful check on what the Environmental Protection Agency was saying. And what your listeners probably already know is that we have cronyism that's really operating any kind of government system that we have, whether
yes.
you're in
yes.
the whether you're in the old Soviet communist country of, you know, Russia, or whether you're in present day Japan with what the parliament just did over there, supposedly a democracy, or whether you're here in the US when we're supposed to be a republic and this isn't supposed to happen, you're going to have the cronies come in and basically take over all the different federal agencies with their appointed people because they have paid so much money to either the Democrats or the Republicans that they get to have the appointments of their key people in our federal government, or in the case of Japan, or in the case of Russia, or in the case of China. It doesn't matter. Okay.
Right.
And so what happened with the EPA during the March 11th, that's when the earthquake happened. Berkeley, the students there pointed out, and they showed the graph, something very peculiar. The EPA had hired an independent contractor to maintain approximately 40 radiation monitoring stations across North America. And on March 11th, after the earthquake had hit Japan, so there was no possible fallout that had hit the U.S. yet. It takes about 6 days to hit the West Coast, and it has to travel across the U.S. Fully 9 days have to go by before the entire northern America continent is hit mm-hmm. by any kind of fallout from Japan. But on March 11th, a full 6 to 9 days before we would get hit, the graphs that showed normal radiation amounts of a certain level dropped across the nation by at least one order of magnitude. It was damn peculiar. The students said, what the heck is this? Here we are seeing these graphs, and I have this in my book. It's going along, and sure enough, it's reading a certain amount of radiation, and it had been doing this for months, if not years, and suddenly the same graph on March 11th, not just on the West Coast, but everywhere across the nation, showed a dramatic drop.
What's that about?
Okay, so they named the company, and they named the person in charge of the company. It turned out it was an ex-State Department official, one of the undersecretaries of the State Department. And I looked her up, and sure enough, she had started a private company, and they had contracted with the EPA to conduct their monitoring system for the EPA.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, well, let's do some more reading here. And I did some more investigation. And on their website, I don't know if they've taken it down or not because of my book, because this is back in early 2011. I found on their website, and I captured it. So now I have it documented, and I put this into the book. They brag on their website about how they are the first company that they're aware of in the United States who does this monitoring across state lines for any kind of data gathering, that they have perfected a software system that at the push of a button, they can recalibrate all of their graphs across the country instantly.
Wow.
And I went, wow. I said, okay, so they have the ability. I said, I don't know if they did or didn't, but if you look at all these graphs, they all show this dramatic plunge on March 11th. Well, by the time the radiation started hitting us, 6 days later here on the West Coast and 9 days later on the East Coast, these spikes that we did see, because these monitoring stations did record spikes, they were shooting up, but to an order of magnitude less. So they could hide this from the public. Now, I said to this, you know, I was really upset about this, but this is exactly what they do. This is classic 60 years of doing this, and they're really perfected at it. So I said, look, we have to get data from those same areas who measured the same radiation, who are going to come out either intentionally to spill the beans or because they don't know any better that they're spilling the beans. Well, I waited a few months, and sure enough, the National Geological Survey, it's a department of the U.S. government, they happen to be unwitting exposers or whistleblowers of the EPA, because they came out with data that was much, much higher than the EPA had documented. That was number one. Then number two, we found through Freedom of Information Act, there was a gentleman who I'm not associated with, but he was quite persistent, and he had this brilliant idea that no one thought about. It turns out that on every nuclear power plant in the United States, they are required by law to measure every single second the amount of radiation in the general area of the nuclear power plant. So what he did was he filed for Freedom of Information to get that hard, raw data, and he got it. And it clearly shows that during the time of the Fukushima fallout hitting North America, that they had these huge spikes. So it wasn't from the plant. The plants reported no releases. And it wasn't just at one plant that showed the spikes. It was everywhere, all the active Damn. U.S. nuclear power plant. So then it confirmed what my suspicion was, that the amounts of hit that we took here in the U.S. were much, much greater than the EPA originally reported. And then lastly, just 2 days ago, we had a release of data that related to what everyone is kind of was thinking is a safe haven to talk about the amount of radiation release. And this is so crazy, but this is how it happens. When you have a nuclear bomb go off or you have a nuclear accident occur, you don't just have one kind of radioactive particle. You've got maybe 80. And some of them are much more toxic than others due to the fact that they can spread better because they get airborne or they enter into the food chain or are passed up. And they have, you know, significant half-lives of 30 years or something like that. Well, when the initial accident occurs, you have these noble gases, these elements, these atomic particles that don't react with anything. They're considered inert by the consensus of science, but they're radioactive in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone was saying, okay, well, apparent permission from the world bodies that would normally want to cover up data. We have implicit permission to publish the actual amount of the inert gases that are radioactive that were released because everyone kind of thinks, oh, that can't cause anybody any damage.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's two problems with that. Number one, radioactive anything will cause damage. But number two, it also tells you indirectly all the other amounts of radiation that had to have occurred at the same time that they know causes biological damage. Okay, so now the spin has to begin. Mm-hmm. Now the spin is, oh, just because that this data 2 weeks ago or less in the that was just released just a few days ago, but it was published 2 weeks ago, just because it says that, oh, wow, we had no idea that this amount of radioactive inert noble gas was released, that doesn't mean that these other radioactive particles were released in basically the same ratio amounts. That doesn't mean that. There's all kinds of variables that doesn't mean that these other really nasty radioactive particles were released. Mm-hmm. But they've got no science to back it up. None. So this is the last embarrassment that North America, oh, no worries. The amount you got was just tiny and it doesn't, you know, compares to normal background radiation. Nobody needs to worry. No, that's not true. Now, let's figure this out from the point of view of your listeners. The Republic of the United States is a government of the people.
It's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be, but it actually is. If everyone stood up and did what we needed to do, the government would go in our direction. There's no, because we outnumber them by such great numbers.
And that's true too.
So we can't, my point of view is that we can't trust our politicians anymore.
Right.
And we have to take back the power because we have a great constitution. We can take back the power appropriately. We do it at the voting booth, but we can also do it locally. And we have to start with ourselves.
True.
If we become unhealthy, if we're not thinking clearly, if we're weaker than we used to be, there's not a lot we can do to help our family, help ourselves, or help our neighbors in time of a crisis. So if we know what the danger is and we know how to fix it, we don't have to worry about the propaganda that the U.S. is doing and say, hey, government, wake up and help us. We don't have to do that. We can become self-reliant and we can fix it ourselves. And this is what I'm going to explain to your audience right now how to do
Perfect.
This.
Yeah, so the damage isn't done. There's hope.
There is a lot of hope. And not only hope, but a lot of science behind it to assure everyone that we can do something about this now. Okay. If we're being treated with chemotherapy for cancer, or if we're being treated with radiation therapy for cancer, or we're being treated naturally with herbs for cancer, they all do the same thing. They all produce hydrogen peroxide to kill the cancer cell.
Okay.
The only difference is that conventional chemotherapy doesn't just kill the cancer cell by making hydrogen peroxide. The residuals of the chemical can poison the rest of the cells of the body that are healthy, and the amount of hydrogen peroxide that's produced is rampant throughout the body. Same thing with radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Radiation will produce hydrogen peroxide to kill the cancer. But if they don't cone it down and keep it really focused, and the amount of rads that they give you is totally is going to burn that entire tissue up. It's going to destroy, incinerate it. It incinerates it by causing a huge production of hydrogen peroxide. Okay, now if you're using a natural approach, that's the name of the game. If you can make a formula and set up a protocol that uses vitamin C and uses juices and uses herbs that will produce an excess amount of hydrogen peroxide only in cancer cells as opposed to healthy cells, then you can see that this is the best strategy.
Of course.
Of course. But here's the cool thing. Why can natural substances, where a lot of chemotherapy is discovered by the natural herbs, why do herbs tend, in almost all cases, to produce an excess amount of hydrogen peroxide in cancer cells to kill it, but not in normal healthy cells? And here's the secret. The reason is because of antioxidant enzymes present in normal healthy cells that aren't present in exactly the same way in diseased tissue like cancer. So that's how we take advantage of the situation. We can use the same herb like curcumin, like turmeric, to make an excessive amount of hydrogen peroxide in cancer, but that same herb in the same amount will cause healthy cells to become more resistant to hydrogen peroxide at the same time because the enzyme systems are slightly different. It's totally cool. Well, when you realize that when we're being poisoned, not by radiation therapy, which is like I'm going to blast you with gamma rays, but rather by particles that we inhale and we eat through our food, and then they lodge for months, if not years, in our body, what is it that they're doing? What's our enemy? They are sitting there trapped. It might be in our bone if it's strontium. It might be in our brain tissue if it's cesium. It might be in our thyroid if it's iodine. And they sit there and they only do two things. They produce a massive amount of hydrogen peroxide nonstop, like an ever-ready battery. They just keep on going, producing hydrogen peroxide everywhere, wherever they landed. And if they're a toxic heavy metal, because all this comes down from uranium, which eventually makes lead, all these substances that come off are toxic heavy metals. So here's the solution. Our body is inherently able to deal with hydrogen peroxide poisoning. Number two, our body is inherently able to remove heavy metals. So what the Russians did when they were looking at how to help all these people that were poisoned, they didn't have any money because the government was in denial. So they found cheap methods that they could remove the ingested and the inhaled radioactive particles from the children. They found that there were forms of edible, high-grade food clay, simple, that would pull it out, especially in the intestinal tract.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that there were certain seaweeds and algaes that were inexpensive that they could feed to the kids. It didn't taste that bad, that the kids would take, and you know, whether it was a capsule or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they got up to 70% of the radioactive material out of those kids.
Wow.
So they had, So that was pretty big deal.
Yeah.
So they still had 30% still in the body. That was the problem. So then they went looking for how to deal with the other 30%. Now, I won't bore your listeners with how they tried to figure out that 30%, because we got to look to 9/11 that happened here in the United States to get into the hard science about what really to do about that other 30% that's going to stay there and keep on burning you with hydrogen peroxide. When 9/11 happened, there was a call, an honest call by our federal officials to say, hey, look, if anybody has any ideas how to help with this enormous problem, we're under attack from any perspective, any kind of counter-espionage or what to do with dirty bombs or whatever, please, would you please contact us, because we are overwhelmed. We don't know. So a private company came forward and said, hey, look, we believe that we know how to protect the first responders. Because if there is a dirty bomb that goes off in the U.S. and it's radioactive dirty bomb, then they're going to be the first to be exposed. They're going to inhale a lot of this toxic material that's radioactive that sits there and causes problems, and they're going to wind up with all this cancer. Mm-hmm. And so they said the first thing to do is prevention. So let's start there. In our homes on the West Coast, whether you're in Alaska, whether you're in Canada, or whether you're all the way down to California, if you're on the West Coast, if you have a good charcoal air filter, a HEPA charcoal air filter that's in your home, you've done yourself a world of good.
Really?
Yeah, that's as simple as it gets. And it can be an $80 unit that does most of your house. It can be two $80 units that does upstairs and downstairs where people normally hang the most. You can put one in your bedroom for another $80. Just high quality HEPA with charcoal. That'll remove the stuff that goes airborne. Okay, that's number one. Number two, you do the same kind of thing for your water filtration system. You can go down to Target and you can buy their zero water filter. And so all the water that you get, you just put through that, or you can get these more expensive units. And you can alkalinize, you can add good minerals back in, it can remove by charcoal all these toxins, and you can spend $4,000 if you want to. It doesn't matter. But for $35 to $40, you can go down to Target, and for maybe $80 to $100, you can put an air filter in your system. And during times of rain, especially when you know that there's been a major release from Fukushima, like, for example, if you hear there's a criticality fire at Unit 4, take your shoes off and take your coat off, if you're wearing one, before you go into the house. Leave it outside.
Interesting.
Okay, so and then last thing, where do you buy your foods?
Oh, man.
Now, this I outline in my book very carefully. If you have orange trees, if you have pear trees, apple trees, cherry trees on the West Coast, like in California, if you have almonds, walnuts, pecans that you're growing on the West Coast of North America, no worries. That food's okay. Just wash it, because there's clay in the soil. To a certain amount, there's going to be clay everywhere. And when the fallout hits, it's going to land onto the fruit or to the outer shell of the nut, which can be washed off, and then it's going to land on the ground, and it will not get into the roots of the tree. So all the nutrients that are being pulled into the final fruit or into the final nut or seed, if it's sunflower seeds, for example, isn't going to have radiation in it. But if it's food that's grown at the level of the soil, like strawberries, like mushrooms, like carrots, like lettuce, like eggplant, all those kinds of things, like asparagus, you could be running into serious trouble there. So buy that food from other parts of the country that's organic. Okay? So we get our eggs, for example, because we always get organic eggs. And we know that chickens that are organic chickens, they're going to be allowed to scratch feed out into the dirt.
Right.
We don't buy our eggs from the West Coast. We buy our eggs in the case of Wisconsin or Texas or for some other place. In the case of dairy, same thing. Do not buy. I recommend nobody buys dairy from the West Coast. And I say get it from Wisconsin. Get it from the East Coast. Now, there's one organic dairy herd in California that's been monitoring their milk supply for radiation since the start, because they were very conscientious people. They're very brave. And the last reports I've had from their firm, I won't mention their name, but I praise these people. They could not find any radioactive contamination of any significance, and that's a tricky word, by the way, that was in their milk supply. There's a problem with that. You cannot detect the amount of radioactivity in food with only a very narrow number of pieces of equipment. Liquids are extremely difficult to get accurate readings from. You have to do it in another completely different way. So we have the problem that we're not monitoring and not capable of monitoring what could be at the top of the food chain, one of the greatest dangers going into our systems over, say, months or years, that eventually would cause us to have thyroid cancer, lung cancer, bladder cancer, breast cancer, uterus cancer 10, 15 years down the road. It's invisible. We can't taste it. It's undetectable. And we don't know that it keeps on accumulating in our body. So here, number one, we use special clays or zeolites or fulvic acids or certain herbs and algaes that are known to pull the radioactive particles out to pull it out. Whatever we're taking in that we don't know, we simply make it part of our normal daily routine. It can be food selections. We don't even have to take dietary supplements, especially if we don't think that we've been exposed to a tremendous amount. But if you think you have, thank God we have the really super duper clays and the super duper zeolites to get it out of the body.
How do you know? How do you know if you've been exposed to a lot or a little?
Well, you have to look at, number one, I suggest everyone, honestly, either goes to my website. I published a lot on this, so you can get an idea. And if you really want to know more, you can get my book. It's on Kindle or it's through Amazon, and you can sort of gauge it. Like, for example, if you were on the West Coast.
Yeah, San Diego, actually.
Okay. If you're on the West Coast, from Alaska all the way down to San Diego, I suggest that you look at my website, and I give a way for everyone to see exactly the kinds of things that you can buy in your local health food store to give you either a basic rad protection program or an advanced rad protection program or an optimal rad protection program. And I describe in there the differences so that people can say, you know, I had a couple of chest x-rays, I had some breast x-rays, I had some dental x-rays, and so that's done some damage, and I've been eating food here grown on the West Coast since Fukushima, and it was a lot of rain going on at that time, as I recall it, and I've got young kids, sorry about that, and so I think I need a basic program, or I think I might want to, you know, the advanced program. I can go out. I can get those things at the health food store. I can afford that. And so people can make their own selections there. They can make their own choices. For those people who know that, like I'm working right now with people in the military service who were directly exposed, that's heavy duty. They need the optimal program. And it's set up into three different ways. The optimal program uses the best materials known in the medical literature that have been proven to take these heavy radioactive particles out of the body. That's number one. Number two, I'm also helping those antioxidant enzyme systems that protect against hydrogen peroxide. I'm ramping those up by select nutrients that are also known in the medical literature to be able to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. Things like NAC, it's an amino acid. Things like selenium, a common mineral that you buy in a health food store. Not so common in our food, but in a health food store. Sorry about that. And also melatonin. Now, melatonin is responsible for growing inside the body an enzyme system that protects us from the hydrogen peroxide. So between the melatonin, the NAC, and the selenium, and then maybe some B-complex vitamins and vitamin C, you have a wonderful basic rad protection program that is not that expensive to put together. Okay, now then I take the last step, and this gets into my research over the past 30 years. I am a both a medical doctor, and I'm a chiropractor, and I'm a certified acupuncturist.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I look at things is very differently than most doctors do, whether they be naturopaths or they be conventional medical doctors. It doesn't matter. I look at things different. What I see is basically what we're talking about here. We have enzyme systems in the body that work a billion times faster than any drug, than any herb, than any homeopathic, than any mineral that we can put together and either inject into somebody or give that, have them take it orally. So what is that system about?
Yeah.
That system I call the regeneration effect within. It is a system that operates billions of times faster to repair and to restore and to normalize than any substance by itself taken from the outside can do. So for the past 30 years, what I've been looking at is, hey, listen, what is it in our diet? What is it that we can supplement with that will activate that system? Don't go after the cancer. Don't go after the radiation poisoning directly. Use the system that's within the body that operates at a billion times greater efficiency and a billion times faster than any other single substance can.
Yeah.
To get that back going again.
That makes sense.
There you have the full story of my research, and I will give one example because people, the first time they hear this, they can get it, they can grok it, but then they say, "But wait, how does that whole system work?" And it's not that difficult to understand.
Perfect.
Your listeners right now have between 10 trillion and 50 trillion. Normal human cells that are sitting in the chair or riding in a car or walking down the street with radio on their head or listening to this interview. That's 50 trillion human cells. That's the number we're going to use. Every single day at the age of 25, when you're healthy, inside the genetic core of each cell, you have no less than 100,000 mutations or injuries that occur within just the nuclear core, just where the genes are. Now, you have at least that many in the cell body general, and at least that number on the outer membrane of injuries and mutations that occur as well. So if you multiply 100,000 that takes place in one cell by 3, you have 300,000 of these serious injuries that result in each cell each day. If you multiply that by 50 trillion, that's the number of damages that you have going on when you're healthy at the age of 25. Okay?
Wow.
At the end of a 24-hour time period, we know for a scientific fact that the healthy 25-year-old repairs all of those serious injuries. That system is the regeneration effect within.
Wow.
Nobody's studying it. Nobody. But that is what regenerative medicine really, truly is all about. So I figured back 30 years ago when I realized through having a group of doctors come and grab me by the scruff of the neck and shake me and said, please, don't become a conventional MD. Please, don't become a conventional chiropractor. Please, don't become a conventional acupuncturist. Please look at that system. Because then you have, if you know how to turn it on, you have regenerative power to kick things back into gear, and your patients will be able to utilize any medicine they're taking, any vitamin they're taking, any nutritional supplement they're taking 100 times better because you're focusing on this incredible system within. So it turns out that we learned a lot of information about that through the longest lived human beings on the planet. There's about 30 different cultures that we have serious data for. And what they're doing, and they're not related, they're scattered and they're in remote locations. But we have enough data to know that what these folks are doing is a couple things. They don't start their aging process until they're 90 to 100 years of age.
Oh my God.
Okay? This has been shown with clear scientific evidence. So wait a second. How in the world do they do that? Well, it's through the system. They're feeding every single day the exact ingredients that are necessary to keep that repair system, that incredible repair system that operates perfectly at the age of 25. They're keeping it going until they're 90.
Wow.
That's why we have nobody healthy here in the United States.
Right, yeah.
There's nobody healthy. I don't care if you're 5 years old. You're not healthy in the U.S. Why? Because we have departed. We have departed by light years away from that regenerative lifestyle that the longest lived people live. Now, I'm sure that your listeners, because you explained to me who your target audience was before we went on air here, that most of them have probably seen the movie Avatar.
Yeah, I'd say so.
You say so. Probably most have. And that what they will grok from this is, I like that word. That
it's a good word.
Yeah, that those people that were represented there in the big giant blue people, okay, that on Pandora, they didn't need anything from modern science. They didn't need our medicine. They didn't need our schooling. They didn't need our enrichment of this or that, or money, of gold, to make them feel like they had a better life. They already had the perfect life. That's the same thing that's true with these 30 different cultures, the ones that are still around. Some of them have been wiped out. So they don't have any hospitals. They don't have any doctors. They do use herbs. They do get sick from time to time, like a cold. But then they feed themselves and they fast and they drink unique waters, and suddenly their immune system becomes stronger as a result of that little bit of cold or flu that they had, so that next season they don't get the cold or flu.
Interesting. So how can we jumpstart that a little bit?
Okay, so that's a great question.
Because I need help, man. I drink a lot of soda. I get most of my food from a drive-through window. I'm a mess.
Well, you're young, and so eventually you will have no choice. You'll have to start. So basically what I have coming out in my regeneration book, this is my first one. I published it in 95. It's still available, but it was focusing in on only one superfood. And I have to say that it's likely that I actually coined the term, because I have publications that date back to the 80s where I used the term. But it wasn't – it was a coin. It was a neologism that I put together for the purpose of illustrating what the longest-lived cultures had already been doing for 5,000 years. So it wasn't my discovery, but it was something that I could say, hey, listen, there are foods and there are superfoods. Well, I have, because everyone now is using the term superfoods, and a lot of them are not, okay? A lot of these aren't superfoods. I'm going to define what it is that superfoods truly are, and I'm going to rename it because the term has been abused. I am going to say that it's regenerative nourishment, and they are all embryonic foods. They're sprouts that have been grown in mineral-rich environments with tons of colloidal minerals present in the water if it's hydroponic, or within the soil where the soil is laced up with bacteria that eats the minerals. It is nuts and seeds that are from trees that are from mineral-rich areas. It is organ meats that are eaten raw. And of course, in the United States, we don't eat raw meat. It's just something we don't normally do.
I get close, man. I eat some raw meat. I've been told that, like, red meat is bad. But are we talking about just the organs, or are we talking about the meat itself?
We're talking about dairy herds or other animals that are raised on extremely mineral-rich soil. And we're talking about their organs, not their muscle meat. And fortunately, there are freeze-drying techniques, so you can put these as powders into capsules, that you don't have to taste them. You can just swallow them with your meals. That's what a significant number of these 30 longest-lived people eat on a regular basis. And then there are special oils, like from bone marrow, that they boil all day long in soups. And those oils are released from the inner part of the bone marrow, where they are activators of these embryonic food factors. And there are things like cracked bee pollen. There are things like cracked chlorella that are grown in uncontaminated areas. There are things like spirulina. There are things like Aphanizomazon flossaqua from Klamath Lake, the blue-green algae from there. There are vegetarian alternatives, but they're not quite as good as the meat sources. For example, if you really are averse to eating organ meats that are from organic herds that that feed off of mineral-rich soil, which is hard to come by, if you really don't want to do that, okay, then you need to seek out dairy and eggs that are like that. So if you don't, well, the eggs, that could be a life. Yeah, but don't eat fertilized eggs then.
Right, yeah.
Just get the eggs from chickens that scratch feed from extremely healthy soils in Texas and make sure that the eggs aren't fertile. And either, you know, on the box it usually tells you it's fertile or it's not fertile, okay? So there's a way to do this. And then you say, now what else do the longest-lived cultures do? Well, they keep their bodies very hot, very warm by exercise, and by the fact that their organ systems are much stronger than ours. In fact, their bones are up to 3 times thicker than ours are. So our thyroid is the key master organ. For practical purposes, our thyroid is the key master organ for our immune system, for our ability to replace old dying cells or disease cells with fresh good ones. For every operation in the body, even for the other endocrine system that we have to have, the thyroid makes that work. Unfortunately, going into 1950, this part's not unfortunate, this part's a true statement, we were number one in the world in health in 1950. As soon as we started experimenting with above-ground nuclear explosions and then turned on nuclear power in the 1970s, we plummeted in our health. We're now about 40th in the world, even though we spend $8,200. Well, with Obamacare, we're going to spend about $16,000 per person. But currently, we spend $8,200 a year on healthcare per person in the U.S. We are 40th in the world in overall health. The next closest nation, which has a totally socialist form of medicine, is Norway. They spend about $3,200 per person for everyone in their nation. They rank about 20th in health. And then you go down from there. Japan, they spend about not quite half of that, and they rank about 10th in the world in overall, maybe 13th, depending upon the year you look at the data.
For now.
And so not now, though, right, because of Fukushima. So you look at, well, what is it? If it's socialized medicine, whether it's traditional medicine, where they use mostly herbs, whether it's in India, where they use mostly homeopathics, whether it's, you know, whether it's the United States, where they use mostly allopathic medicine, what is it that causes the healthiest people to be the healthiest? Number one, they have no hospitals. Number two, they have no doctors. Number three, they have mineral-rich soil that starts their food chain. It's where their medicinal herbs are grown. It's where their water comes from. It's where their animals and their chickens produce the eggs and where their buffalo make the milk that they consume. That's the medicine. That's what Thomas Edison said. The doctor of the future will use no medicine. He will use foods as his medicine. And Hippocrates said, let food be thy medicine, let medicine be thy food. So we don't have that available to us in the United States. Even the organic farmers are not putting rock dust into their topsoil. Some are. It's very rare. Some biodynamic farmers, which take it a step further, still are not using rock dust to put these trace minerals back into the soil. Now, when we do, we emulate the longest-lived cultures. Their thyroids are monsters. They can go out in the middle of a snowstorm with nothing on. This is a true story. The Hunzas are known to do this. They go out, and for something fun to do, because they've been locked inside, they run down to the lake, they drill a hole, and then they run 100 yards, and they drill another hole. They jump into the ice water. They swim to the other hole. They pop out, and they run back into their hut.
Damn.
Just for some fun. That's what they do, okay? And they also can jog nonstop 60 miles during the day. and turn around nonstop, and they're munching the whole time on their special food they keep with them, and they're drinking the mountain water, and run back the same day.
Powerful.
Powerful people. So to answer your question, I've reduced this with my third edition of my first book that I published in 95. I've reduced this to a 55-minute daily program. As long as you're making your food for the rest of the day in a proper way, which is smoothies. Everyone can make smoothies in the morning and take it with you, okay? If you do a 55-minute daily program first thing in the morning, it will replicate all of the most common features that these longest-lived people do their entire day.
Interesting.
So that's something that you can do. How old are you, Greg? I don't know.
I'm 28.
Okay, so you're 28, and guess what? You're just about 25. You have abused your body. You come from parents that probably didn't eat from the right kind of soil.
Right.
So, yeah, you might be, in terms of like an Okinawan who's 100 or a Hunziket who's 90, you might actually be about 50 right now compared to that
Wow.
kind of person. You might be 55. You might even be closer to 60 if you have any sort of aches and pains and low blood sugar and you wear glasses and you've got cavities and all. You might be closer to 60-year-old Hunziket. Okay?
Jesus.
But by you doing a 55-minute daily program first thing in the morning before you get going, you can bring yourself back to that 25-year-old that you ought to, that you were entitled to be, that you were born with the blueprints inside your body to be.
Nice. So what does that entail? Like, what are the most important parts of that?
Okay, so I can't give that to you in the short radio interview.
Sure.
I can say this. When I looked across all 30 of these cultures, and I reduced it down this way to see what specifically turned on this regenerative effect within, it always came down to four, I call them pillars, four categories of practice that every single one of these people did. There wasn't any outside of this type of activity. It was always within these four pillars. The first pillar, disciplined detoxification. I'm giving you an example.
Okay.
These people that are in remote areas, they are usually farmers and they do a little bit of hunting, but they have to store their food for the long winter. Most live in the high altitudes. Not all, but most. And so by the time that late spring comes, they basically have run out of food. They have plenty of water, and the water now has this glacial milk component to it because the glaciers from the mountaintops nearby have been pushing down and crushing all the rock all winter long. And now that it's melting, all this milky white water is running down, and they're the first to grab it. So for the last month before the food supply starts kicking in again, like the first sprouts start coming up so that the cows can start grazing off this incredible sprout material that but now they're not really producing much milk because there's not much left. They're eating old hay and things like that. They have to fast. They have to fast for a week or two or three or four before their first small harvests start coming back again and they can start eating.
Damn.
So when the anthropologists went there looking at these cultures, if they just happened to arrive in the late to mid spring, they would see nothing but emaciated people and said, oh my God, these poor people, they're starving to death. No, they were detoxifying for the entire past year.
Interesting.
And then they immediately went into the raw food, the embryonic foods that they could get into the first parts of summer, the late parts of spring, and then they became super invigorated in short order. So that if the anthropologist happened to come for the first time in late fall, they saw this magnificent population of people that were like incredibly strong and friendly and happy and like human beings they had never seen before. This is well documented by McGarrison back in the 1910s, 1920s. He was a British general surgeon, and he documented this in the Hunziketts. Okay, during the middle of wintertime, they slow down. They kind of go into a meditative state if they're in the mountains, and they eat nuts. They eat the cheeses, they eat the fermented foods that they've been storing, and they drink lots and lots of water. And they usually get a cold. And in 3 days, it's gone. And they take some herbs for it. It makes their immune system stronger for the next round the following year. And they have done this for 5,000 years. I don't care if they're in the Caucasus Mountains of old Soviet Georgia. I don't care if they're in the Himalayas, which was in northwest Pakistan today. I don't care if they're in Okinawa near the beaches. I don't care if they're in Nicoya, Costa Rica, in the mountains of Costa Rica. I don't care if they're in the mountain foothills of Ikaria, Greece, an island. I don't care if they're in Sardinia, the island just off of Italy, in the foothills there. I don't care. They all do this.
Interesting.
This is what they do. So that's the first thing, disciplined detoxification. Second thing, super oxygenation, maximal oxygenation through the way that they practice, whether it's physical yoga for somebody inside their house here in the U.S., or whether it's going out and taking long walks on the hillside like these other people do. You've got to get a massive dose of oxygen into every single cell of your body, at least at peak saturation. And then you're good for 48 hours. If you do it right, you're good for 48 hours. So you can accomplish that within about 16 minutes. It's called high intensity exercise. And if you're breathing oxygen during that time period, literally actually breathing pure oxygen during that time period, and you know how to do it, you know how to do it safely, and you have a doctor or a chiropractor or a naturopath that's working with you, it only takes 16 minutes of that 55 minutes to accomplish this. Say you're on a treadmill, say you're on a gazelle, say you're on a rebounder, say you're on a stationary bicycle, anything like that, you can breathe in pure oxygen for 16 minutes, and then you're done. Your body is super saturated with oxygen, just like these longest-lived people, because they exercise all day long. Third thing, eating a healthy amount of raw food, about 50%, which is 100% accomplished by smoothies. Doesn't have to be a big deal.
Okay.
Now, you don't have to be a big deal.
Let's talk about what's important to put in those smoothies, because I could make a smoothie a day. You know, I've messed with the – I've got a juicer here. I got to dust it off now. But, you know, I just lacked the education of what to put in there.
So, you go back to the longest lived cultures. What is it that they're – now they're not making smoothies, of course, but they're masticating their food down to a pure liquid. And they chew 100 times before they swallow any food. They're different. They sit around. They socialize. So they basically make a smoothie with each mouthful of food is what they're doing. And what is it that they're eating? Well, they're drinking this incredible water that has this incredible amount of minerals in it.
Alkaline water.
And they have alkaline water, and it's also alkaline, but it's structured, meaning it's wetter. It's more wet. So it can penetrate into the body better to drop off these good minerals that are found in huge amounts, and it's wetter to pull the toxins out of the body.
Is there a way we can get that kind of water?
Is there a source you recommend? We can make it ourselves, and I have that up on my website. People can go to my homepage under drapsley.com, and then on the sub-tabs to the left, upper left, you'll see Getting Started. And just click and read. You'll see how to make it at home. Okay. If you want to do it in a big glass jar. Okay. And then they're consuming these embryonic food factors, whether they be – I like mushrooms. I love
Me
mushrooms
too.
Because they are among the strongest of the regenerative nourishment that you can – they're better than algae. I love algae, by the way, a blue-green algae. I love it. I love chlorella. But there's nothing that compares to the right kinds of edible mushrooms. They're just unbelievable what they can do.
Amen.
There's dairy products that you can use, particularly what Gerson used to help cure cancer with his diet therapy was farmer's cheese, the homemade cheeses, because it concentrates the whey. It concentrates the whey. So within the smoothies, if you get high-quality whey, that will form the basis of it. And then you can throw things in there like a little bit of algae or a little bit of mushroom powder, or you can throw in there some bee pollen, whatever is your choice that makes it taste good. And then on top of that, I throw in powders of vegetables and fruits that have been raised properly on mineralized soil. And right now I'm looking for the right organic sources, because like I said to your audience earlier, there's a lot of this organic fruits and vegetables that aren't grown on mineral-rich soil. So I've been real careful to get those. This is for convenient. Somebody who's in the city, somebody who doesn't have time to maybe juice. I prefer juicing, by the way. But if you don't have the time, you throw in a couple of scoops of vegetables and fruit powders that are grown from mineral-rich sources, and it makes it taste even better because it's mostly kind of fruity in terms of its taste. And then you just throw in some liquid. You can throw in water. You can throw in Fiji water if you don't have a water filter. I prefer Fiji water for a lot of reasons. But you can use smart water. And so people who are in a jam, they're located in New York City or L.A., they just go out and buy some smart water or buy some Fiji water. They dump it in there. They add some whey to it. They might add a banana and a raw apple if they have a big blender that goes at high speed. And they throw these powders in there. And they in 60 seconds, they can make their entire day's supply as long as they keep it refrigerated and they add a little bit of vitamin C. Just not much, just a little bit. And that will preserve that part of the diet, which can accomplish 50% of the diet raw, and it'd be absolutely delicious. Okay? Then the rest of your dietary selections, depending upon your blood type, it's really your metabolic type, but most people are familiar with blood type. If you're a vegetarian kind of person, your blood type is type A. Not always, but it's usually type A. If you're a meat eater and you need this organ meat,
yes,
then you're type O blood. AB is kind of a combination of both. Metabolisms are instantly energized by the kinds of foods that they're eating. And traditionally, these long-lived people that go 60 miles fast walk and jog during the daytime, 60 miles back during the nighttime, and then they go to sleep and wake up the next morning for a full day of work. They are eating exactly what is tailored to their metabolism. They could be lacto-ovo vegetarians. In the case of the Inuits, they could be 100% eating salmon for most of the year with some grasses and berries during the summertime. It just depends on in their type of blood. It just depends on where you're coming from, genetically, from your family tree, I mean. So if you're type A blood, you can favor a more vegetarian cuisine. You don't have to eat 100% vegetarian, but you can favor that as type A. There's rare exceptions, but that's mostly true. If you're type O, it's going to be really important that you get in at least a little bit of meat each day. It could be sushi, not from the Pacific.
Right.
You know, but it could be sushi if you enjoy sushi. It could be capsules of liver from organically raised cattle sources from New Zealand or from Argentina that are uncontaminated. It could be raw eggs, as long as they're organic and they come from healthy chickens. They won't get salmonella poisoning that way. Or you can loosely cook them. Or you can use bee pollen. You know, even though it's still a vegetarian source, it's more of the meat of that kind of part of the vegetable kingdom. But because that there is this difficulty for some people if they're ideologically or philosophically a vegetarian, that's where I discovered mushrooms. Mushrooms are so potent that anybody can use them, unless you have an allergy to mushrooms, and they'll fit into this regenerative effect system within, no matter what your metabolism is. So I'm big on the mushrooms. And that gives you an idea about the third pillar. The fourth pillar is the psychological. It's the mind over matter. It's the getting rid of the negative, dirty attitudes that we have today towards life, the hypercritical, the government's bad, my mom and dad are bad, I have a bad spouse. You know, it's getting rid of that, just discarding it. It's not important. It's adopting a sincere resonance with the higher kingdom. Now, what is the higher kingdom? The higher kingdom is about the liberation of all of the stresses within the confines of the body.
Okay.
So we have two different forms of approaching that. If you're doing physical yoga and you're in a posture and you're really stretching out and you realize, oh my gosh, I have put a ton of stress into that calf muscle, it might be painful. And as you go into it and you surrender into it and you keep doing that posture, suddenly after a period of a half hour of doing the posture correctly, that stress that you emotionally, because you had an argument with your spouse, or you had an argument with your kid, or you had an argument with your parents, suddenly that stress is gone from that part. It's like a battery of storage. It's gone from your calf muscle, and you come out of the simply doing half a yoga, and you say, wow, I feel good. And the next argument that they want to bait you with, you say, I'm not playing today. Hey, listen, you know, I really love you and all this stuff, and I, you know, I feel so good right now. I wish you felt as good as I do. I've been doing this regenerative program. It only takes me 55 minutes in the day, and I've been drinking these delicious smoothies, and, you know, and it's open to anyone. You can go down and you can buy whatever's available at your local grocery store. It's not a big deal. You can do it cheap. You know, I feel so good. You know, you ought to try this, because I'm not playing the game anymore of sitting here being critical with you. I don't have time for this.
Right.
Okay, now, one last thing about this, Greg. We have what was set up in the 30s and 40s, because we remember, we were number one in world's health in 1950. Mm-hmm. We had our soil becoming exhausted going into 1960, because we started using the wrong kind of fertilizer after World War II. And William Albrecht at the University of Missouri had recognized that where cultures had exhausted their soil, they became highly aggressive and started wars in order to conquer new land.
Wow.
They intuitively knew that the where they were under the stuffy conditions of the earth and the cities and all this kind of stuff wasn't supporting them. So they suffered from what William Albrecht called the hidden hunger. And they became very violent individuals. They became deranged, and they'd go off and they can conduct warfare, and they'd collect all the food. Listen, now that you guys have been conquered by me, you have to grow food for me. You have to give me your gold. You have to give me your silver, because I can't support myself in my present territory. I'm going to force you to do that. This is what we're seeing today with our form of government.
Yeah.
It's redistribution of wealth, because Americans are so unhealthy that they can't take care of themselves any longer. And now we have to have a medical system that doesn't work anyway, because we're all unhealthy, that now becomes socialized, but it's run by a big bureaucrat costing twice the amount of money. Yeah. Like, that's going to get us back to the longest lived people that don't even have a hospital or a doctor. I mean, give me a break. It's not going to work, because the causal reason is we're not dealing with the four pillars that all of the long-lived people use to keep themselves vital and healthy and non-aged until the age of 90, and they all have a pleasant disposition, they love each other, they empathically feel another's pain. If their neighbor is in distress, they are all there to help, because they otherwise feel so good. They don't need the marijuana. They don't need the alcohol. They don't need the tobacco to get high. They're all highs, because they feel they already are high. We've got, I don't know if you know this, the endorphins that are in you, Greg, the endorphins that are in me, the endorphins that are in your audience are 1,000 times more potent than morphine. And we're not turning them on. It turns out that marijuana is a very interesting substance, by the way.
Yes, it is.
Marijuana has the exact same chemical that we're supposed to make in our body. We're supposed to make endocannabinoids, but we're not. Every single cell in your brain, every single cell in your heart, every single cell in your liver, everything that makes you vital has dozens and dozens of receptor sites for cannabinoids. And so what do? Because we're suffering from the hidden hunger, because we're not getting it naturally from within, we go out and we find marijuana. And oh my God, this is my savior. I finally feel right.
Mm-hmm.
But understand this. The longest lived cultures feel 10 to 100 to 1,000 times better than the greatest high from marijuana.
Wow.
Every single day of their lives. These are different human beings than we are. So it's no wonder that the kids today want the marijuana. It's no wonder that we're changing our state laws to legalize marijuana. It's no wonder that we want Uncle Sam to take care of our health medical bills.
We're supplementing. It's
because we can't do it ourselves. Why? Because we have such a great hunger that we can't satisfy.
Yeah, we're supplementing for sure. Damn. And that's the four pillars. I mean, if we do those things, that's basically the key. That's going to counteract the damage done from the Fukushima meltdown. That's going to regenerate the damage done from all our shitty food. That's the key.
From the perspective of us being on the West Coast, that is exactly correct. We can, in our own kitchens, according to our budget, we can practice the four pillars a day if we're religious about it, doing it every single day. It takes about 3 weeks that it locks in, that we start feeling so much better that we never, ever, ever want to return to feeling as bad as we didn't even know that we felt.
Wow, powerful. Man, John, it's been a blast. You know, that pretty much brings us to the end of the show. I mean, that's been a jam-packed hour of information. Yeah, I feel slightly inspired to change some of my bad habits. I've felt this way in the past, but I mean, it's like, why know the information if you're not going to do anything with it? You know, why take in the real story about the Fukushima meltdown and the fallout from it if you're not going to do anything about it? So yeah, I think it's definitely important, man. I definitely appreciate you coming here. Vast knowledge on Fukushima, and the work on regenerative health is great too. Is there anything else you want to tell the people about? Maybe your website, where to go to get more info on what you're working on?
Yeah, just so that folks know, I've got within the next year, maybe within the quarter of next year, I'll have a book coming out on cancer. It's about the regeneration effect, how to regenerate, not treat the cancer, and the cancer goes away. I will be updating, it's almost all done right now, my first book called The Regeneration Effect. It's for everyone. It talks about all these regenerative nourishment foods from the long-lived cultures like the mushrooms. That'll be out by the first part of next year. And for anyone who wants to get started right away, they don't have to wait. They just go to my website. Again, it's drapsley.com, D-R-A-P as in Paul, S as in Sam, L-E-Y.com. And on that homepage, that's about 70 pages. It's a long homepage. You can see pictures of these longest lived human beings. You mm-hmm. can see the entire message of the four pillars. But on the upper left subtab, there's a getting started page. And that's how to change, how to do this 55-minute, most of it, not 100%, but most of the 55-minute per day program you can extract out of the Getting Started tab.
Okay.
So there you go.
There you have it, people. Oh, man. Well, thanks again, Doc. You know, it's been a real pleasure. I'm going to have to start getting some mushroom capsules. I'm going to have to get some raw organ capsules, some nuts, some bee pollen. Got to make sure they're from mineral-rich soil. Is there anywhere in the States you can get that from, or do we have to? Have we just trashed our own land and we got to go somewhere else?
Well, I have to answer this for full disclosure. I have to feed my family this way, right? I have seven kids. I've got four grandkids, so I had to find all these sources. So I have put together what I believe to be the best sources of these. And so anybody who writes me, I'll give them the links. They can find sites where they can. This is available to them. My email address is john@drapsley.com and drapsley.com.
Okay, excellent. Well, people, if you want to take care of yourself, there's a good place to start. I am blown away by the Fukushima stuff. Very crazy how serious that problem is. When you can't see it, it's easy to just pretend it's not there, but it seems like we're definitely going to be needing to do some countermeasures because it's pretty powerful stuff. So be on the lookout for what moving unit 4 is. That kind of right now, is that like teetering still?
Yeah, anybody who writes to me, we sign them up for a free newsletter. I also sign them up for receiving a free recipes for these smoothies that we've been talking about. On my website, drapsley.com, there's a main tab at the top, radiation antidotes, and they can go there and they can see updates. I document it. It's all, like my book, for example, has 1,000 authoritative references behind it, and I have updates on that tab. So you can see what the latest information is, but then I also have this newsletter. In fact, we have our next newsletter is going out next week. So just email me and you'll be part of our newsletter list.
Awesome, man. Well, much appreciated, John. Take care of yourself.
You too. And that's been a pleasure.
All right. There it is. John Apsley, dropping knowledge. Man, I've also recently read there have been pretty high levels of radiation in the snow in Texas and Missouri. Not good. Also, there's this headline I keep seeing that says off the coast of California, about 150 miles, 98% of the seafloor is covered in dead animals. And before 2011, it was only 1%. Really fucked up. I don't even know what to say. Let's just ignore it and hope it goes away like we do with our cell phones. All right, that's the show. The second THC Money Bomb starts today. Thanks again to everyone who participated before. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing the show, reviewing it where you can. We're getting more and more iTunes reviews, and we are getting more and more steam because of that. So please review the show where you can. If you can't, donate to the THC Money Bomb. And if you can, please do. Let's grow that thing, and let's really make an impact on episode 90. Good night, and good fucking luck. Let's go to Japan. I'm not joking this time. So go get your bags packed, or we'll be just fine. We both wear kimonos, no shoes on our feet. Just take my hand, Japan it with me. It's an archipelago, exotic and pure, of ancient enchantment, so says the coming. Let's go to Japan. I'm not joking this time. So go get your bags packed, or we'll be just fine. We'll both wear kimonos, no shoes on our feet. Just take my hand, Japan it with me. Don't misquote me. I'm not disowning my country. We'll come back one.
People, thanks for listening to THC and taking a serious look at some of the most underappreciated topics and ideas on the planet today. UFOs, HARP, a resource-based economy, archons, psychedelics, MKUltra, mind control, Hollywood sorcery, self-sustainability, and a ton of other stuff. We want the truth about the topics that spark our curiosity and expose corruption, but it's become buried in an avalanche of glee in the Fast and the Furious movies. Well, not anymore. Folks, if you like listening to the show week after week, please take a second to nominate us in the 2013 Stitcher Awards, the most prestigious podcast awards known to man. And what could be a real shining star on the Higher Side Chat's resume? It gives your humble host the clout necessary to remove all barriers that may stand in the way of reaching potential guests and allows the momentum to continue. So please take a second to find a link on my Facebook, Twitter, or the Google itself for the 2013 Stitcher Awards and write THC and wherever you think it fits. Why not try to sweep the whole damn thing? But particularly, let me extract your precious nomination in the science and medicine category. I don't know why our show is listed there, but we're 14th in that category, which means we're in the ballpark, but we're going to need the whole team to make it happen. We're 14th. That's pretty good. 14th above Michio Kaku, above Scientific American, above National Geographic. Don't get me wrong. We've done great things this year, you and I. But a nomination in the Sitcher Awards means putting Lennon Honor and Freeman Fly and Wendy Tremaine and Jim Elvidge and Jock Fresco alongside people like Rachel Maddow, Joe Rogan, NPR, and ESPN. Because those are the people who will win the 2013 Stitcher Awards, and that's okay. But help me put Project Monarch alongside fantasy football. Help me put Crop Circles alongside the NBC Nightly News, even for just one day. And I'd say we've come further than we ever have. So please, vote every day between now and December 22nd. This year, let's get on that ballot. And next year, that's the year we go for the gold. Your move, Higher Side Chatters.